And what we found is, and we call those boundary cells or cognitive boundary cells, is that they are cells that fire whenever the narrative changes. And these cells, it turns out, after many years of work, when you watch these cells, what you are observing is the creation of a new episodic memory, of a new chunk, of a new file, so to say.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and I really want to thank you for joining us for another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. Please do like and follow us wherever you listen to your podcasts or get your video cast. We're on the road today at the annual Society for Neuroscience Conference here in beautiful San Diego, California, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Dr. Julie Rutishauser, Professor of Neurology and Biomedical Sciences and Director of the Human Neurophysiology Research at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Dr. Rutishauser is a distinguished neuroscientist whose research has uncovered how our brains separate, store, and retrieve memories. His lab has helped pioneer the technique of human single neuron recordings and continues to advance the tools, methods, and surgical techniques that allow such experiments. His work has illuminated the roles of specialized neural cell types, such as boundary cells and event cells, in segmenting our continuous experiences into distinct memory episodes. Dr. Rutishauser's research has important implications for understanding and treating memory disorders, as well as shedding light on neurological conditions such as autism and epilepsy. He was the recipient of the Trolland Research Award from the National Academy of Sciences. Julie, thanks so much for coming in and taking time out from your busy schedule here at the Society for Neuroscience meeting to have a chat with us about your work and your perspectives. Really appreciate that.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So can you tell us, dive into this business of how our brain separates, stores, and retrieves memories, why that flows through both? What do we need to know about this?
Yeah, so I'm very interested in this question because it how we form memories and how we use memories is really what defines us as humans. And I think we can all relate to this when we see what happens if these things don't work anymore. So how devastating that is. So I'm very interested and dedicated to figuring out the fundamental mechanisms that allows us to form memories and then use them flexibly and keep them.
And then you do something rather remarkable. And I think, you know, it's space age stuff. When you talk about putting electrodes into the human brain and actually recording from single neurons, like electrodes so fine and so precise that they can grab onto a single neuron and ask what that neuron's doing. Tell us about the evolution of that technique and the role that your lab played in that.
Yeah, so that's indeed our main technique that we use, single neuron recordings. And the reason we do that is because one of the main reasons we don't really understand how human memory works is because we can't look at inside the brain. We can't watch what the neurons do and how they talk to each other. And as a result of that, we know very little about the brain. And there's, of course, we can't in general do this, but there is rare clinical circumstances where we can insert these electrodes and these kind of experiments can be justified. So then we can really listen to the individual neurons while somebody thinks or makes a memory.
Right.
And that technique has a long history. It has been pioneered by neurosurgeons many decades ago by now, who have long realized that they have something very precious in their hand. They can actually advance fine little wires so close to a neuron so that they can listen to what many refer to as the atoms of cognition.
Right, the atoms of cognition, yeah.
So that's a very experimentally demanding technique that we can only use in certain populations, of course.
Yeah.
But it has revealed it.
Right, we need to make clear to the listeners and the viewers that you're not going around just sticking electrodes into human brains. These are people who need surgeries, right?
Absolutely. We are not looking for volunteers.
Yes.
these are patients who need these kind of surgeries, these electrodes, to treat their disease.
Right.
And alongside those treatments, we can also do research without increasing in any way, shape, or form the risk they undergo.
Right.
But alongside the terrible thing that's happening to them, we can at least learn something about the human nervous system.
And right, just to clarify too, this is mostly, we're talking here about patients with intractable epilepsy, right? The reason the electrodes are going in there is to try to find where the focus of the epilepsy is so that a neurosurgery can be performed.
Absolutely, yes. So epilepsy has this interesting property that certain types of epilepsies, you can tell that the seizure always starts in the same location.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so-called focal.
Yeah.
And if we knew where that location is, we could treat the seizures by removing it.
Right.
But we don't know where it is. So those are our patients. So they get implanted with electrodes. It's a diagnostic surgery. It's not treating you. It's a diagnostic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Get electrodes implanted in multiple locations of the brain. And then we record the signals while seizures happen. And then if all the seizures that we recorded come from the same spot, then we can offer surgical treatment and the epilepsy will be treated.
And it can be very effective when it works, right?
It can be highly effective.
Yeah.
It can be highly effective. This is called surgical epilepsy.
Yeah.
But seizures, of course, are rare. So as part of this diagnostic, the patient will often have to stay in the hospital for 2 or 3 weeks till there are enough seizures, and that's where my work takes place.
Yeah, exactly. And I have to say, I have a bit of experience with that myself. And these folks, they realize the opportunity. I mean, they're generally very keen to help
once
they realize that why this is a key opportunity for science.
Absolutely. In fact, where I work, the patients are given a survey after they're discharged. And for their hospital stay, what was your experience? What did you like? What you didn't like?
Yeah.
And they will often point out that their interactions with the researchers, that was one of their highlights.
Well, that's
hospital
terrific. Oh, that's just great to hear.
It gives real purpose to, otherwise you just sit there and watch TV and do nothing. And you wait for a seizure.
Right. And it's boring times, really.
It's boring times and you can't leave. You're tied down. You can't leave the room. You're wired up.
You're wired up. Right. Yeah. So you study memory, and I want to get back there, but there's another key piece here, right, is that it's the plasticity of the brain circuits that generate memories that make them that bit more susceptible to epileptic foci, right? So this is in large part why those electrodes are in middle temporal lobe areas and that. Is that the case?
That's very much the case. Yeah, so the electrodes, they're not in random places. There's a few locations that are almost always strong candidates for the seizure focus, and those strong candidates are all these locations overlap very strongly with the list of brain areas that we know are important for memory.
Right.
And as you said, most likely the reason for that is because they can undergo rapid plasticity.
Right, and that plasticity is a vulnerability to, a crucial for memory formation, but a vulnerability because the neurons can change their electrical dynamics as part of that process.
Absolutely, yes, and there can be too much plasticity, and then it could trigger a seizure. We are all at the very sort of at the threshold.
We're well titrated, hopefully.
We are well titrated, but we are close.
Yeah, right? Isn't that it? Yeah, that's an interesting insight. Yeah. These cell types, boundary cells and event cells, it sounds like something out of Star Trek, right? And that, tell us about those, how you found them, why they're meaningful.
Yeah, so this is one of the discoveries that was really surprised us the most. So the idea here is to say, well, okay, you know, let's think about what we remember from yesterday, what we did, in your life. And what will become apparent is that your memories are really discrete. They're not continuous. They're not like movies.
Right.
You did certain, you went for dinner and that was that, and you saw this person.
A freeze frame.
It's like a freeze frame. Yeah. They are basically, memories are fundamentally discrete.
Yeah.
And our experience is continuous. So the question is, how do we go from one to the other? So what we did is we showed patients short video clips. And in some of these video clips, the entire clip was about the same narrative from the same camera shot. Whereas in other video clips, there were like different aspects. For sometimes a football game, and we zoom in on a player we had never seen before, but it's still the same game.
Right.
In other videos, it would be like totally different games. And what we found is, and we call those boundary cells or cognitive boundary cells, is that they are cells that fire whenever the narrative changes. And these cells, it turns out, after many years of work, when you watch these cells, what you are observing is the creation of a new episodic memory, of a new chunk, of a new file, so to say. So we think they break up the ongoing narrative and they really signal when a new episode starts.
Because
in a continuous experience, it's really unclear how you should chunk it up. You could chunk it up in any...
So if things stay the same, no matter how long they are, that's one memory.
That's one memory.
And that gets condensed into a single slice.
Yeah, you could, your dinner could last 4 hours. It's still only one episode, right? Yeah. It doesn't make the memory any bigger or longer.
Interesting.
You could create 10 new memories in 1 minute if you have a lot of new things happening.
Sure,
right?
Witnessing a bank robbery or something.
Something like that, yes. So these cells are really, and they turned out to be really, really interesting. There's like different types of these cells. Some differentiate, you know, like little transitions, and some only signal, we call those hard boundaries, when there's truly a new memory.
Gotcha.
Like, you know, if somebody would call you now and tell you something super unexpected, that would be a hard boundary.
Like the Jets won or something, unexpected.
Something really, really unexpected. It's like,
Those are the boundary cells.
Right.
And then event cells, what's the distinction there?
The events are, that's what's in between the boundaries.
Gotcha, okay.
It's kind of the same thing.
And all these cells are in the hippocampus, or do you find them outside the hippocampus?
Yeah, these cells are really interesting. You can find them also outside of the hippocampus, but in the hippocampus you find specifically, and very only there, these hard boundaries. These are like big boundaries.
Yeah.
Smaller boundaries you also find sort of more in the input areas to the hippocampus, in particular the parahippocampal gyrus.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're quite specific, otherwise you don't find them in other parts of the brain.
Yeah.
They're really quite specific. And they they're some kind of a, in rodent research there's this idea of having cells that signal geographic or physical boundaries.
Yeah.
This is a boundary in mental space.
Oh, interesting. So you're drawing a parallel to like a grid cell or a place cell here.
Or like a boundary cell. You have these door cells
when a rodent
goes through a physical door. That's how we think of it.
Yeah. So they're space and time not so relevant to these cells.
These cells, they tile time, right? Not space. Yeah. They tile really time.
How interesting. Yeah. That's extraordinary. Yeah.
You
must have seen now particularly over the last decade, a really rapid advance in the technology in the OR for doing these kinds of recordings. Will you speak a little bit about that and how that's sort of opened up new vistas, new frontiers? And then, you know, I suppose for, you know, somebody reading a basic textbook in neuroscience, they'd hear about single unit recordings, and people back in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s would have been recording from a single neuron, but that's not what's happening here. You're recording from a ton of these neurons. So just a little bit about that and how that changes the questions you can ask.
So there, indeed, as you said, there has been really a lot of technological development. And one of the main developments really has been to record many neurons at the same time. So we still call this single neuron recordings, because if you listen to single neurons, we want to emphasize that. But it doesn't mean we listen to only one neuron.
Yeah.
We can listen to many neurons.
How many? Give us a sense there. How many neurons in a typical preparation?
In a typical sort of the side of preparation we have been talking about, it's sort of on the order of 100.
100 neurons.
And one of the fundamental realizations has been in the field, sort of in the computational neuroscience, that listening to even two or three neurons at a time can show you things that you could never see if you only listen to one at a time. And that's because there's neural geometries, geometric structures that are revealed if you listen to multiple neurons.
And
that has been one of the main advances. So it's a computational advance, not so much a recording advance. We have always been able to record neurons, right? But now we know how to look at them in a new way.
So really, there's network. You begin to see sort of network properties, local network properties.
Local.
These are single neurons in a relatively circumscribed region.
Or you see one population of neurons in one area and one population of neurons in another area. But even if you only see them in one area, with these new techniques, we can now really understand how cognitive variables are. are represented at the population level in a sense, in a way that if you only listen to one neuron, you couldn't make sense of it.
Amazing.
And that insight is, that's all computational. Came from theoretical work.
And is AI taking a role in unpacking latent structures, let's say, in those neuronal things that a human may not be able to divine patterns?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, for me, AI is a godsend because I'm not, making AI better or developing it. Quite the opposite. I'm using AI to do science.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
It helps me understand the brain.
Yeah.
And we are using techniques from machine learning to understand the brain, but also to motivate analysis.
Like, right.
To give you an example, in machine learning, if you train a deep neural network to do a certain task, what it fundamentally does is disentangle variables.
Right.
That's what it does. It disentangles variables. So that's how it learns. The question is, does the human brain learn that way? Right.
Yeah.
And we actually put this to the test, and in one particular instance, we could actually show that that's the case.
Goodness.
And that's very, very interesting.
That's very powerful too, yeah.
That was really interesting.
With these recording techniques, do you see a future with brain-computer interfaces, for example, with people with paralysis or other kinds of disabilities, motor disabilities? Are we heading that way with single neuron recordings and having readouts to robots? Is that part of...
Absolutely. I think we are actually very close to that.
Yeah.
There has been tremendous progress, as I'm sure you've seen. We were just at the human single neuron meeting at Caltech, and there were some new cases were shown of paralyzed patients and of patients with ALS with synthesis directly to speech. And that's all based on single neuron recordings, of course.
Extraordinary. What is really, we're at the precipice of here with these technologies and these abilities. And then you add the computing power of an AI system, and really you could see a future for functionalities that people could only have dreamed of 10 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to see that this specific problem of motor BMIs or even speech BMIs have now become engineering problems.
Yeah. Right?
Because the fundamental science, I think it's there now,
so
we can use it.
Yeah.
And build these devices.
What a fantastic... message to our public, where things are going, the hope that's there.
Absolutely, yes.
Are there other things, like when you're sitting at home and somebody says, where's it all going? What's it going to be like in 10 years? Are there things that people don't realize are coming? Sorry, where do you see us all in 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, the frontier in BMI has really now move to things like, what about a memory prosthesis, right? Could we make a prosthesis that improves somebody's memory? Or what about the true speech prosthesis? And the other frontier is clearly psychiatric disorders.
Yeah.
Could there be a prosthesis that suppresses OCD symptoms or schizophrenia symptoms? And a lot of progress has been made in this area as well.
So
I would say that the next 10 years we're going to see a lot of progress for psychiatric disorders and brain mapping devices and prosthesis.
So let's get to you a bit. So you actually came over from the computer sciences into this area. Tell us about that transition and what drove you into brain science.
That is correct. Yes, I grew up in Switzerland. I studied computer science, or really software engineering, as we called it back then.
Yeah.
Towards the end of my undergraduate degree, I became really fascinated with machine learning, fairly primitive back then, but still. And I did machine vision partially, mostly. As I did this more and more, I really started asking myself, how does this actually work in the brain, these same processes? And then I discovered that my entry point was this, that there is a field called neuroinformatics.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, neuroinformatics, that sounds incredible.
Yeah.
So I had a mentor at the time in Zurich at ETH who is a professor of neuroinformatics, and he introduced me to this world.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I want to become a scientist. I want to do this. And then I decided to go to graduate school and learn about neuroscience.
And graduate school was in Switzerland?
No, that was in the U.S. So then that's when I came to California, to Caltech, Pasadena, where I did. They have a program called Computation and Neural Systems, bringing these two things together.
It's a world-famous program, yeah.
And that's where I ended up doing my PhD degree, and that's where I learned all the biology I know.
Amazing. Tell me about that jump. You know, you're growing up in Switzerland, you do your undergraduate thing. It's a big jump to come over to California. And tell us about that period and what it felt like.
Yeah,
that and also was to walk through the gates of Caltech, of all places. It must have been quite something.
It was amazing. Yes. It was my first trip to the U.S. actually. So come straight to Los Angeles, go to Pasadena.
Yeah.
And I felt at home right away there.
You did.
It was like, wow. Yes. Yeah. There's all
no culture shock or anything like that.
No, because it was the first time I really felt like, wow, I'm in a place here where everybody does nothing but science.
Amazing.
And they day and night.
So you're just getting out. You're getting up in the morning with like that buzz, I can't believe I'm here.
And it was just incredible. I've never been in a place like this before. So I felt immediately when I went to interview, I was like, okay, I need to go here.
Wow. Yeah. I love it. That's fantastic. You know, we often talk on this show about the American science engine and how unparalleled it's been in history and how it's drawn people like ourselves from Europe and from all over the world, that this is the epicenter. And you just described it beautifully.
Absolutely.
The excitement.
I'm like, I have never experienced something like this in Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah.
Ever.
Now, of course, that brings up the question, do you worry about it where we're at these days? I don't want we're not going to go deep into politics or anything. But.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this is one of the defining characteristics of the country, of America.
Hear, hear.
That we have this culture of welcoming people from all over the world to do their best science.
Yeah.
And that we are risk takers and we allow this.
Yeah.
I think it's foundational for this country. And look at all of our colleagues, where they're from. They're all here doing their best work.
Yeah,
not back
absolutely.
Home. And they're all here for that reason.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so many come and think that they're going to go home, and then you stick.
They stick. They never go home.
The environment is so.
In fact, I went intermittently almost home. I did a postdoc in Germany, not in Switzerland, after I graduated, and I really looked forward to going back.
Right.
To the U.S.
So you're a lifer.
For sure.
Yeah.
I'm for sure a lifer, and it's. Because it's very rare to find this kind of place where you have some idea and people are like, yeah, why don't you try it?
Give it a go.
You know, where I grew up, that they would be like finding all the reasons not to do it.
Precisely.
Oh, that's too risky. Why would you do this? Oh, no, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, I absolutely the same experience. Mm-hmm. Although I do see a change in the scientific enterprise in Europe, and obviously in China, they're really, really, amplifying their efforts there. We often talk about the sort of competition between American science and world science, I'll call it. But do you see it that way? Shouldn't it be all of us together? And isn't it? I'm hitting you with an opinion here, but push back, of course. That the American model has raised the scientific enterprise elsewhere because of people like you, some of our colleagues who went back and said, you know, this, you've got to change how you do business.
Undoubtedly.
I mean,
I know many places in Europe who look to us and say, we need to copy this.
Yeah.
We need this too. And in fact, this happened in many places. They have tenure track positions now, and that's sort of the American model, away from the old professor having 100 people to... You know what we have, which is small, agile groups.
Small,
I think,
and
we
agile.
Have sort of exported that model very successfully.
So, agreed.
But we need to keep it to not be overcome, of course.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about human single neurons, clearly, the U.S. is by far the leaders in this field.
Yeah.
But you know, that doesn't mean others are not close.
That's right.
And it's
there's a very, very good group in Geneva doing incredible intracranial recordings. Yeah, so.
There's a very good group in Bonn in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They're
Cologne. Yeah, there's, yeah, right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So there is, it's a strong competition.
Yeah, and which is good. Another good American ideal.
Very good. Yes, which is very good. But we need to keep at the forefront.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You mentioned, you know, a mentor and moving into neuroinformatics and the sort of role of a major mentor in your life and sort of opening a big door and a big new vista for you. How do you approach your own mentorship experiences? How do you deal with your trainees? And are there any secrets there for folks? Any tips, top tips?
I don't know about that, but I'm definitely trying to, pay back what all the mentors that made my career possible did for me. I'm trying to do it for the next generation. I mean, one thing that I have certainly noticed in my life is that the most pivotal moments, the sort of really those that changed everything, they were completely unpredictable.
Things that are tickling your boundary cells like crazy.
For example, or the things that really mattered, they were on the periphery.
Interesting.
I think one important lesson is to just be ready for those moments.
Can you give us an example, or is that unfair right now?
No, that's not unfair. You know, for example, when I was studying in undergrad, I was planning to. I didn't know anything about graduate school. I wasn't planning to go to graduate school. I was going to become an engineer, not a scientist. But that connection that connected me to that professor that changed everything was like the most remote connection. Right? It was through a job I worked. And at that job, I knew somebody who, knew this person and so on. And it's often like that.
Isn't it?
Those things that
really... But it was a butterfly flaps its wings. I mean, but we've heard that time and time again from folks, if you're open to it, it's an open mind as part of it and a sense of adventure.
Absolutely. I mean, once you're given one of these opportunities, of course, you have to be ready to take it.
Yeah.
Otherwise... they're gone.
So that's a note for mentees for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Same thing for how I ended up in human single neuron recordings. That wasn't planned at all. It's something I came across through, it's a funny, at Caltech you're doing free rotations in three different labs.
Yeah.
And I was going to join this one lab and they said, but you still have to do a third rotation. So I was like, okay, fine.
Dutifully trudged up to the door.
So that was the third rotation, right? Yeah. What I'm doing now.
Amazing. Look at that, that's a great system. We should explain that, actually, right? So when a graduate student, and this is a fundamental difference. In Europe, you go to graduate school, you go to a lab immediately. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, you even apply to that lab.
You apply to the lab.
Which is terrible, because as an undergrad, what do you know?
Right? You know nothing.
You know nothing. So how do you know who you should apply to?
Yeah. And you get that person, and that's the person you're stuck to them for the next 4 years of your life minimum.
Right.
But here, you get admitted to the graduate school, and go ahead, tell us how it works.
Yeah, so the American system is such, you get admitted to the graduate school, and the admissions committee is not the people who will work with. They evaluate your qualities and your fit and so on. And then what you do is you do what's called rotations. You work for typically 3 months with one professor and then another one and another one. So you can explore different things.
Yeah.
And you can say, I've really never heard of this. Let's see how this feels doing this.
Yeah.
And very often you will find many, many examples. People will find out, A, the thing they wanted to do, they really don't like it.
Yeah.
And B, the thing they really, really like, they have never done before. They're like, oh, wow, I really like this.
Yeah, it's great. It's
like
great.
In my case, I discovered, I actually really like doing experiments. I had never done experiments before. I was a theorist.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this third rotation, that was the experimental rotation. I was like, wow, I actually really like doing this.
That's great.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
But without just trying things you would never know, right? And I think it's a key feature of the U.S. system.
Really love it. Is. That's I think that's really, really important, this business of, again, it goes to that keeping your mind open and keeping the doors open, and then a system that's set up to make you do that.
Yes.
By saying, you like the first lab? Sorry, you got to go do two.
You still got to do that one.
You still got to go to the other ones. There, keep your mind open. I noticed, too, in some of your background material, that it's not just graduate students. You have undergrads and high school students in the lab, and that's important to you. Tell us why that's important and why that's part of your...
Yeah, very important. I think I've experienced over and over that it really matters that you have in a research lab or in a research group a very wide range of levels of experience, of seniority.
Yeah.
Any level of seniority, somebody will look at the problem a different way. So that's one big benefit. And the other benefit, of course, is we wanna really motivate people and bring them in early on. So that's where the high school students come in, or the undergraduates.
That's great.
Because then, in a way, that's the biggest impact you're ever going to have.
Yeah, yeah.
If you change someone's career choice.
Yeah. You're a teacher at heart, too. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that goes... That's what it means to be a professor, to teach.
I know. You'll often find science professors who very begrudgingly do some teaching.
Absolutely,
They really just want to be in the lab. And
I kind of used to be this way, but the more I've been teaching, the more I've discovered that it really actually helps me to think through things.
Yeah.
And I've come to really enjoy teaching them.
Yeah.
And it's true, I think, very true, that you only truly understand something when you can teach it.
Yeah.
Because you think you understand it, but then the night before you prepare a lecture, reality hits.
The cold sweat.
You're like, wait, I don't actually really know why this is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever had this experience.
I certainly have, yes.
This
is the emperor's new clothes kind of situation. It's, I got to stand up in front of 200 kids tomorrow
and
I can't remember.
Exactly, 8 hours.
Yeah.
And I don't really know why this follows. So,
yeah.
I think it's critical to do good research.
Yeah,
I believe.
Outstanding.
And
Tell me, go ahead,
enjoyable to see how young people think. And
Tell me, maybe this is the last thing I'll ask you. Tell me about you when you were that age. What was the schoolboy Uli like? I know the computer science thing was a key component, but what were your motivations then? And if somebody came and said to the 10-year-old Uli, you're going to be doing single neuron recordings in the human brain in California, I think you'd be a bit surprised. Is that fair?
I would be very surprised, yes.
Yeah. So
at that time, it was all about computers.
It was all about
programming.
Computers.
I wanted to program.
Wow.
It was all about computers. Yeah, I wanted to learn how compilers work and how I could make little games. I'd be very surprised. I definitely... never thought I would essentially become a biologist. Who would have thought?
And were your mom and dad academics or?
Yeah, of sorts, yes. They work in industry, but my mom is a physicist, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, my dad is a chemist.
Okay, so the science force runs strong in the family.
Yeah, that's true. That is true, yes. But I'm the first one really working in academia. That hasn't happened before.
And when you headed off to America, were they, oh gosh, there goes our little boy off to the other side of the world, or?
No, they were excited
they
for
were
me.
Okay.
They were excited. They knew that was my passion.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
That was my big break.
Yeah.
To get that admit decision.
Uli, your passion for science literally oozes out of your pores. So thank you for coming here today to share that with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a
really
wonderful conversation.
Outstanding.
Really enjoyed it.
Great to see you.
Thank you.